From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made after Labor Day, when thousands of New York students go back to school in this state. As you probably know, Governor Cuomo has green-lighted the reopening of schools. That's because there are low infection rates in all regions of New York State. And the governor says right now, this is the time to do it. Well, that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. Districts are free to devise their own schedules and plans, and many are choosing hybrid models. Districts have to determine who has to wear a mask and where and when, and what the penalty is if you don't. Districts must communicate their plans for remote learning options. They must communicate their plans for handling cases or clusters of cases. School reopening has not gone all that well in early opening states like Georgia. Did you see the photo from a Georgia high school of packed hallways and almost no one wearing a mask? The superintendent of that district said he can't enforce masking and that everything looked fine to him in the photo. Today, the Washington Post reports 6 students and 3 staff members in that school have already tested positive, and it's going to temporarily close to in-person learning. But districts in New York do have some advantages. They have the advantage of time, watching how things go in other places. They have the advantage of much lower rates of community transmission. The hope is that they can open and welcome students back without becoming the site of further outbreaks. This hour, we welcome more superintendents to take us through the plans. Hilton School Superintendent Casey Kosorek is back with us. Casey, thanks for making the time. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me today.
Well, it's great to have you back here. In just a moment, we're going to welcome your colleague from Brighton, Kevin McGowan. In fact, I think I see he's on the line now. Kevin, welcome back to the
program. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome back to the program. I'm laughing just because we just locked you in there. Didn't know if you're nice to have you, Mr. Superintendent. How are you?
Oh, listen, I've never been better. I'm glad to be on again. I missed you, and I'm happy to talk about this topic, so thanks for having me.
Well, we all wish we could see one another in person, but let me ask you both to kind of run down the plans here. Casey, I'll start with you. In Hilton, last time you and I talked about 5 weeks ago, I know that there was a lot of concern about hybrid models and how complicated, but frankly, everything is complicated in a pandemic. What is the plan in Hilton?
So at this point in time, we had hoped to bring students back every day, but we ended up with a hybrid model. So in Hilton, students K through 12, we've equally distributed a cohort, and that'll be a Monday-Thursday attendance and then a Tuesday-Friday attendance. And then we also have a third cohort, which would be students with special needs, really looking at the special education models of 12-1-to-1, 8-1-to-1, 6-1-to-1, getting those students back 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. And then we also offer a fourth cohort, which is a completely remote experience.
All right. And when it comes to your expectations and what you're hearing from members of the community, what's the breakdown of what you expect to have in terms of students in the classroom when they can be versus full remote?
Well, I believe that we will have a very good number of students in the classroom in the hybrid model. The majority of our community would like to see the students back 5 days a week. You know, one of the challenges with the guidance was clearly transportation, and we also have some concerns around staffing. Are we going to be able to provide that staffing due to underlying health conditions and other matters that we have to work on the personnel side of the business? But I believe it's a small number right now. The last time I checked, we have around 162 students out of 4,500 students who are their families are interested in that full remote return.
Okay. And when it comes to teachers, have you surveyed teachers about any concerns or expectations for teachers who might not be either able or interested in coming back to the classroom?
Well, it's a little bit more about able than interested. Mm-hmm. So working with ADA compliance and vetting doctor's notes as far as staff not being able to return. So we've surveyed our staff. We have about 75% return on that survey at this point in time, and we're looking at roughly 30 staff members, not just teachers, that at this point in time, and we haven't gone through the whole vetting process yet, the preliminary numbers, that may not be able to return because their doctor has written them out.
30 staff members total out of how many people in the district?
Around 900.
Okay, so low number. I think that's 3%, roughly. I might be doing the math wrong, but that's a pretty low number, and that, to me, looks like that's a strong enough number that indicates you're going to be able to open when you want to open. Is that fair to say, Superintendent Kocurek?
Yeah, that's our goal. We've worked together with the teachers in the community to do the best we can with the current information and guidance. And our goal is to open, and we hope that numbers continue to go down and possibly some of the expectations as far as social distancing and whatnot may be relaxed over time as the transmission rate goes down, and we can bring more students back more frequently because we want them in school.
Superintendent McGowan in Brighton, what is the plan?
Very similar. So we have A through L on Mondays and on Thursdays, M through Z students on Tuesdays and on Fridays. That's K through 12. On Wednesdays, we are what we are referring to hybrid remote, which means all students K through 12 would be learning virtually all day from a remote location, and our staff members would be providing instruction based on a schedule that looks very much like their in-school schedule. So for 6 through 12 students, they'll function on their cycle day that they would typically be in, so A day, for example, and they will go period by period as if they were in school. Their location now is not room 262, for example. It's their couch or their living room or wherever they do their work from. And K through 5 students on that hybrid remote day would have a similar schedule. They won't be on a Zoom for 6 hours, though. They would likely start their day with some type of community building activity, introduction of some type of material, perhaps small group work throughout the course of the day, check in again middle of the day, additional instruction provided, and sometime in the afternoon as well. And those schedules are all being finalized at this point. What we focus on is making sure that those interactions are meaningful, that they are taking advantage of the time to the best of our ability, but also that they make the most sense considering the developmental level. We also have a cohort of students that we would are coming in based on their individual education plan needs, their IEP needs, so special education students, some of our most, I would say, quote-unquote, at-risk students. In other words, they're in a particular specialized programs where they're going to be receiving additional instruction, and that's K through 12. They will come in 4 days. It's a relatively small number of students. And then we also have an all-remote option for families as well, and that would take place Monday through Friday, again, operating on a cycle day calendar, very similar to the way I described for kids on that hybrid remote day for the kids in the hybrid program. But the all-remote kids will have a similar type of program. Our all-remote kids will see their elementary teacher K through 5, 5 out of every 6 days in the cycle on screen, and the other day being continuous learning activities provided. And our 6 through 12 students, 4 out of 6 days, we currently have a drop day in their 6-day schedule, and so we would provide continuous learning on the days they don't see their teacher face-to-face.
What is the number, if you're making plans or making assumptions or at least dealing with the feedback you've heard, Superintendent McGowan, what's the number roughly of students who you expect to be full remote?
I think our numbers are very similar to those of Hilton. I think it'll be ballpark 10% or so. We're really early in finding that out. We sent an email to our community members last night asking them to make commitments by next Monday at 8 p.m., every single student we need to hear from so that we can schedule every single student. It's a pretty complex Rubik's Cube that we're dealing with relative to staffing available and when they would be teaching in person versus when they're teaching remotely. We assume at the 6-12 level we'll be assigning some teachers, for example, 4 sections in person, 1 section remotely. So we really need to know from every family. And the early returns are pretty close to 90%. In person right now, and I would expect those numbers to hold fairly consistent, but we'll see. We'll know in about a week.
I want to ask you about teachers as well, and as I do that, I want to read a little bit from NPR and an NPR, recent NPR survey, while also noting that I think this kind of survey is kind of precarious. I mean, I am not a professional surveyor, but I can understand why, if you have a conversation with somebody who is a teacher or even someone who is works as a secretary, is a bus driver, works in the school in any capacity, it might depend on who they're talking to, how much they want to be open about it, whether they've got anxiety or concern. So I'm not doubting these numbers at all. I'm just saying that it may be contextual. So let me read what NPR and Ipsos found in their survey. Quote, 2/3 of U.S. educators would prefer to teach remotely this fall. According to a new poll conducted by NPR and Ipsos, the poll also found about 16% of teachers say they will not return if their school reopens. That is far more than Superintendent Kocurek is finding in Hilton. And again, it may, A lot of context here may be missing. Superintendent McGowan, what are you hearing?
I think the numbers for us will be similar to what Hilton's reporting, and we'll know more. You know, I love how Casey described able versus interested. And to the point you made about the context of the survey, interested, concerned, don't want to return when you're given a blind survey, I am sure that number would be high. I think that we share that concern. In fact, it would be strange for people to not have some anxiety in the current context. The question is, do you have enough anxiety that you can't surmount based on the safety precautions that are being taken or the accommodations that you are being given to actually make the leap to not return? Those are two very different things. Now, keeping in mind, there are many people that have very, very legitimate reasons based on their own health needs of family members, et cetera, that they shouldn't be returning. And we recognize that and want to make sure we're taking care of that as well. So I don't want to diminish the anxiety or the concern at all. That's very legitimate. But I do think you're right, the context matters. When asked, are you concerned? Sure, a lot of people are going to say they're concerned. When asked, are you concerned enough not to return? I think that number will be bigger in a survey like that because you're not actually putting pen to paper saying, I will forego my income, forego the benefits of my job to do that. It's pretty easy to say in a survey, similar to the NPR one, well, I'm not going to go back. But how many people actually end up doing that will be a different question. Again, I think our numbers are similar to Hilton's.
And then we have to remember that teachers may be dealing with being parents as well. And I've got a question emailed from a local teacher who asked the following. What are the districts doing to support teachers and staff who need to also be home with their own kids 2 to 3 days a week due to their own kids' hybrid learning schedules? Superintendent McGowan, has that come up?
Yes. So this is a really interesting question. I know that there are many community members, I don't mean just Brighton, but broadly, right, who look at that and say, well, listen, I had to figure it out for my job. And I get that. And then there's also the duty as an employer, school or otherwise, an employer, to think about how to create the best environment for their teaching staff, the best workplace, be the place where people want to work. So many employers, to get the most out of the human resource capacity they have, try and find ways all the time in regular circumstances to be a great employer and to provide for their employees. We're usually in a challenging situation as public employers in our use of public funds to provide those perks and those benefits and need to be very cautious about that, need to understand that we're spending public dollars in that way. However, in this current circumstance, we are presented with this big challenge of many teachers have children at home and their school districts are in the same situation we are where they're not able to offer education every day in person. In other words, kids will be at home a certain percentage of that. And we have to find the right balance constantly in our obligation, though, and our primary obligation, our first job, is to provide for the children in this district that community members are paying taxes on behalf of. So, yes, we want to make sure that we're being a good employer and trying to find ways to accommodate people. But our first obligation has to be to the children in front of us, and we take that very, very seriously. And to some degree, want to be flexible, and we want to provide programming, and we want to provide resources where people can go for childcare and for help in that way. But we really have to narrow our focus as much as possible on the kids that are in front of us and on the education that we have to provide, and can't be all things to all people in every way. So it's about finding an accommodation, about being reasonable, about being flexible, but understanding that our primary obligation has to be to the kids that are walking through our door and to the families in this community.
Same question for Superintendent Kasorek. What would you say to that teacher who emailed us saying, hey, I'm a parent too, and what am I going to do about this?
Very similar to Kevin's response. Truly, we want to be a great employer, but our first and foremost, we really need to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the taxpayers of the Hilton Central School District and the students that attend our school district. So if we can make it a win-win, we surely will, and we'll look at ways to resolve those types of situations. But the first matter at hand is to tackle the education of the students here in the district.
All right. Listeners, if you've got questions or comments for these two superintendents, We're talking about the various plans for reopening schools. And Brighton and Hilton represented on the program today. We've heard from various other districts in the last few days. We will continue to have these conversations to answer some of the questions from listeners over the last few days. Yes, we are also reaching out to teachers. And we're not trying to sort of stack any conversations in any directions. We want to have many conversations. These are some of the most complex problems anybody in schools will have to solve probably in their career, and certainly we hope so, But we do want to hear from teachers as well. You can email us, connections@wxxi.org, if you'd like to talk on a future program. A parent emailed us yesterday and said, you haven't talked to students. We are sensitive about that, and our thought after our conversation this morning was, we should talk to students. I don't think we're going to do it in a live program. I think we're going to have recorded pre-conversations with students of various ages, because we don't want to, again, sort of load up or put anybody in difficult on-the-spot moments here. You know, when you're 8 years old, when you're 12 years old, it's tough. We want students and everyone to feel comfortable and confident that ultimately people care about them and that we're all doing our best here. But we will talk to students as well, and we're going to try to do our best to do everything in a careful way here. It's not to duck anything. The superintendents aren't coming on this program to duck anything, but we're trying to be as comprehensive as we can. You want to call the program today? It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, or you can email the program. Again, it's connections@wxxi.org. All right, Superintendent Kasorek, everybody wants to know masking policy. Hilton's masking policy is going to be what?
Well, at this point in our phase one of reopening, we are requiring all students and all staff to be masked at all times. We are building in masking breaks via the guidance from New York State Education Department and Department of Health, so our principals are currently working on that. We want to start out with a universal opportunity for those breaks. We want to make sure that everybody understands how to wear the mask. It's funny, you can go to Wegmans and you can see people that the mask doesn't cover their nose. You can see a lot of situations when you go out into our communities where we need to start out and we need to educate both our students and our staff on the proper ways to wear the mask. We also need to educate on social distancing. People have different understandings of what social distancing means. 6 feet is 6 feet is 6 feet, and we really want to make sure that we can get those practices in place. And then as we progress, we can evaluate. We may move into a model where teachers have autonomy on, okay, class, now it's time. We can take our masks down. Everybody is sitting 6 feet apart from each other. Let's do that. But to start out to ensure everyone's safety and to really address everyone's concerns, we're going to start out with a more conservative approach of having masks for staff, students, and guests at all times and then building in those breaks.
Superintendent McGowan.
Same thing. We are a little bit of a modification to that, but very similar to Hilton. We are requiring masks at all time. We just approved this morning at our Board of Education meeting a change to our code of conduct requiring masks for students, for all staff members, and for any visitors, vendors, et cetera, to the campus, although those people will be very limited in the fall. And it has to cover both the nose and the mouth. Failure to utilize the mask would be considered insubordination and subject under the code of conduct to disciplinary action. Obviously, that sounds like a very harsh response. We hope we're not there, but we do need to have that kind of level of seriousness about masking. We do have the opportunity for teachers at this point, when there is social distancing, which is the 6 feet of social distancing, to allow students to remove their mask for a mask break. And we would expect that to happen very rarely, in fact, but they do have that discretion within the classroom. All common areas, hallways, any other gathering spaces, et cetera, we need to maintain social distance, and masks will be worn at all times, including on the school bus. Masks will be provided if students do not have them at that time, and PPE for the adults around us as well. We will allow for medical exemptions, as all school districts will be for masks, but those will be need to be certified through a physician if there's a reason that a student cannot wear a mask.
I am just seeing a headline that is kind of breaking news, and it is a total bummer in the Dawson household because my 8-year-old looks so cool in a gaiter. He wears this buff. He calls it a buff. I think that's the brand. I think it's technically a gaiter, and he's been loving that this summer. Here's the Washington Post headline just out today. Wearing a neck gaiter may be worse than no mask at all, according to new research. Oh, that is such a bummer. Oh, my gosh. Sorry. Oh, my gosh. My boy is going to be very disappointed. But, hey, we're all learning.
For right now, though, Evan, I would want to point out, for right now, if that covers his nose and his mouth, according to New York State Public Health Guidance, the Department of Public Health, until that changes, it would be allowed. But this is an important point. The Washington Post, there's an article every other day, matter of fact, about every hour about something different. We wait for public health guidance, and we'll make adjustments as we go. And we expect to be making a lot of adjustments as we go.
Yeah, I do think that is such a great point to highlight. And we've actually tried to model that on this program as best we can, because throughout the summer, there have been various studies about antibodies. Do antibodies wane in the blood, and what does that mean? It's always caution, caution, caution. Get more data, back it up, repeat the study, make sure that we know. So the one on neck buffs and gaiters, the Dawson household is going to be looking at very, very closely. But we'll look for more research on that, too. And, hey, if we have to make a change, if the research is good on this, we will make changes. Are you kidding? We've got very cool Zelda masks that we can wear. It's very, very cool.
There you go.
But I think that's a very, very good point. One other quick point before I turn to our first phone call. Just briefly, Superintendent McGowan and Superintendent Kasorek, there's been debate about just how much you can enforce things like a masking policy. And, sort of kind of famously or maybe infamously in Georgia, the superintendent of the district in Georgia, where the photo went viral last week, told the New York Times that, hey, we can't make anybody wear a mask. We can have a guideline, but we can't enforce that kind of a policy. Superintendent McGowan, do you agree with that?
No, not at all. I can't speak for Georgia. I can tell you, as far as we're concerned in the state of New York, we are often provided guidance by the state education department what we can or can't do. There's very clear guidance on this relative to masking and enforcing masking. And our code of conduct, as I said this morning, now allows for that type of enforcement. We want to work with families. We don't want to sound so coercive as the way I've described it. But the reality is we absolutely can. We don't allow students to come to school without a shirt on. We don't allow them to come to school without shoes on. I don't see how this is any different. This is a public health need, and it should be done without question.
Superintendent Kasorek?
Well, I would agree with Kevin. And I think the other thing, too, is I'd be curious in Georgia what type of education took place before the first day of school. So I think it's really important, as we've been talking about, is helping students and families understand why we're doing this, the proper way to wear a mask. So less of a responsive and hopefully a more proactive way in educating individuals on why we're going to wear the mask. And I do believe that our teaching staff and our support staff and our administration will do a great job in supporting families and understanding why they need to wear a mask and then addressing it when it doesn't happen.
Yeah, my guess is that photo did not help schools that had yet to reopen when it went viral last week. But we've now talked to half a dozen superintendents on this program. Everyone has essentially said the same thing about that. They said they're not going to criticize colleagues out of state, but they are going to say that is not what school is supposed to look like here. And for parents who've been interacting with Connection, saying, is that what we should be expecting? The answer so far is no. Leslie in Rochester on the phone first. Go ahead, Leslie.
Hi, Adam. I just wanted to, I'm a retired teacher, high school teacher, and I work now for a university. And I just wanted to share what my university did way back in March, which I think was really excellent, but the school districts have not had time to do. Before, when this was understood and known, the first thing that they did, and they spent several weeks doing this, was to think about how they were going to think about it, not what to do, but how were they going to go about deciding what to do. They ended up breaking things into three different divisions. One was the physical plant, one was the educational or academic component, and then the other is what they called like the social human aspect of it. How are people going to respond and how are they going to act? They created committees for each one of those three areas that had representatives from all different areas of the university, faculty, staff, students, et cetera, et cetera. And then they had an overarching committee that those committees reported to. And the entire thing has been watching the most amazing ball of string develop because it's all been very fluid and very difficult. I would never want to be in one of their positions. But I wish, personally, who the heck am I? But I wish that the school districts in New York State had been told to go completely remotely, as awful as a decision as that is, for the fall, so that they could have the time to think completely outside of the box for these things and put together a safe face-to-face opening, hopefully for the spring. I see them doing incredible work, hard work, making the best decisions they possibly can, but it's like you're putting Band-Aids on every little thing, like the boy with a finger in the dike, without a completely overarching plan that they couldn't develop because they didn't have the information. But we do now better. So that was my hope, that we could think completely outside of the box, maybe create volunteer groups of people who have had COVID and had an immune responsibility. I mean, a little bit of immunity to open their house for 3 hours a day to a student who doesn't have online learning. It's something, I don't know what, but completely out of the box thinking, but they need time to do it. And that is all I needed to say. I'm sorry.
All right, Leslie, thank you for the phone call. Superintendent Kosorek, you want to start with a response there?
Well, you know, I love that model. We actually used a very similar model what Leslie was explaining as far as the subcommittees. They included all different stakeholders from our community. We really gleaned a lot of great information from some of our parents and community members that work in the health community and really help support us in developing how we'll screen students and things like that. But I would agree. I think the more time that you have to think about how things are going to work, and just as the caller explained, we didn't have much time. We had actually started planning prior to graduation because we knew we didn't have guidance. We waited for guidance. But a lot of districts were working very hard without that guidance because we knew that our back would be against the wall to open. And when the governor says our numbers are down and we should open, we really have no choice at that point in time. We did have some choice in moving towards the hybrid, which we felt would be a phased-in, conservative, thoughtful approach to attending that. But I think the caller made some great points.
Okay, Superintendent McGowan?
Well, first I'd start with 60 years of innovation in 6 months. We've done more in terms of changing our systems in the past 6 months than probably has happened in 60 years. And so I don't say that defensively or aggressively. I think the caller is spot on in so many ways. I think it's important to recognize, though, that the kind of reshaping and reforming of a system quickly has happened, and it has in so many other sectors, right? I mean, you have distillers who are now creating hand sanitizer. I mean, it's happened, this type of innovation, all over the place. We did have actually many committees. I think your listeners should also know that we were promised guidance in the state of New York in early June. We had been begging for it. We had been looking for it. And that did not come to us until mid-July. And so that caused a serious issue. And despite many of us involved in many conversations with state leaders very directly saying, this is exactly what we need, this is what school districts need to move forward, and this is, you know, what's going to happen, we couldn't get that. And there was a broader political issue around the, kind of the mandate that was given to the governor and his ability to control this conversation, but then our need for guidance to really do a thoughtful job. I would say that despite that, school districts across the state and here locally in Hilton, Brighton, were very thoughtful around bringing large groups of people together to analyze the guidance and then the emerging guidance and then the change guidance. We had two groups, an operations group, very similar to actually what the caller described, an operations group and an instruction group, that really developed very thoughtful plans to think differently about this and had spent months leading up to getting that guidance. So it wasn't just immediate, but many of our internal leaders had been brainstorming and working with smaller committees to develop that kind of thinking before we went into the process once the guidance was available.
Are you disappointed in the governor?
So, you know, I think that's a really hard question to answer in this way. One, he saved thousands and thousands of lives. I would say New Yorkers saved thousands of lives by adopting the practices. And his crisis management and leadership in that moment and bringing us to a place much quicker across the state of New York was very, very important and should be heralded. On the other side, internally, working on really within the bureaucracy, that side, there are things that we don't appreciate and that are problematic for us. And that's kind of on the organizational level, and it's frustrating. It's frustrating because given guidance earlier, given clear direction, but not in a way that purposely publicly shames districts, you know, the 100 districts on the list yesterday, many of whom did submit plans. By the way, I know our local colleagues had submitted their plans in Webster and Victor, and yet they were called out for not doing that. And when they called the health department, they said, oh, well, we do know you have your plan, and we're trying to figure out what the glitch is. Well, that was after the governor had already put out his list and, in a very sarcastic, exasperated way, talks about how, well, people didn't get their plans in. There's so much good work that's being done. And frankly, districts that are engaging their community, engaging their staff, that is happening. So sometimes there's the suggestion in his guidance that somehow people aren't doing these things. And, I don't mean to be overly sensitive as an educator who feels like he's criticizing us, but I think the community should know their local leaders have been all over this and working very hard at it. Despite some of that public rhetoric, it makes it more challenging the way it's approached sometimes. But again, keep in mind, he saved thousands of lives, and that's important for us to acknowledge also.
All right. Let me get Rachel in Gates on the phone next. Go ahead, Rachel.
Hey there, Evan. First, I'd like to say these are kids. Secondly, on the bus ride to school, I've been told that it's one seat apart. And I was told that they can't use anything with alcohol, and they were going to be given Windex to be cleaning the buses afterward. And then the whole, you know, when you stand 6 feet apart from each other, when the kids are entering school for the bus stop, gym class, lockers, you know, and then if somebody comes up positive, I don't understand how they're going to quarantine with, if there's a bus, do they do all the kids on the bus? Do they do all those families? I don't think that testing of taking a temperature and asking some questions is good enough. And I really feel that we should wait until spring and just chill out for a while, see how it goes, see if we could get the numbers even lower.
Rachel, let me just jump in and let me kick some of these concerns to the superintendents. I'll start with Superintendent McGowan. She's concerned, you know, about, you know, sort of following where cases and infections may be. So why don't you take me through protocol in terms of either testing or screening, you know, sort of on the front end. And then if you could, Superintendent McGowan, take us through the process if there are positive cases, whether it's staff or students, what you do next.
Sure. So in the first place, every family will be asked on a daily basis to provide an attestation that their child is coming to school symptom-free and without a fever primarily. And that will be done through an app-based program, and those that have participated in the Rock COVID program would understand that you get a daily email or a text message to remind you. You click a couple simple clicks, everybody's coming in healthy and fine. When they arrive to school in each of our buildings, there will be two temperature scanners. Every single staff member and student will walk through that temperature scanner, and nobody will be able to stay at school if they have a fever. Now, there will be a waiting period where a second temperature will be taken once a student is in isolation, because we realize there will be false positives, and in all likelihood, many of those positives, the temperature will come down and be normalized after a period of time, and then they'll be allowed to stay in school. Should they have a temperature that persists and they need to then be sent home, they cannot come back to school without a doctor's clearance, without a negative COVID test, and without symptom resolution. Should they have a positive test for COVID, they won't come back to school until they've completed the quarantine period and they're released by their physician to come back. If we have a positive case, we will be immediately in touch with the Department of Health. Monroe County Department of Health, Dr. Mendoza, has been an outstanding partner to superintendents in this conversation. We will work with them directly on the next step in the protocol. It is our understanding that what they will do is analyze the contacts that that child or children have had, the extent to that contact, and do contact tracing from there, and then provide us with guidance as to what the next steps will be in terms of notification of a class, of a school, closure of a class, closure of a school. Those are all things that will happen once the public health people, as I like to say often, I may be a doctor but not a useful one, we'll go to the useful doctors and they'll tell us exactly what we should do next in terms of those types of notifications and closures. That's really their department.
All right. Superintendent Kasorek, same question.
Same response, that we're going to follow the same protocol. You'll see most school districts' protocol the same because we're working so closely with the Monroe County Health Department, and Dr. Mendoza has just been an outstanding leader providing that guidance for us.
Okay. Just briefly, can I ask both of you, that, and this is going to take you, you're probably going to roll your eyes and say, really? But let me just ask, because I, like many people who've been tested multiple times, I don't mind the nasal swab, but I would love what we call a spit test, a saliva test, which we've heard some things about in the last few months, but there hasn't seemed a lot of momentum until this past weekend when Harvard epidemiologist Dr. Michael Mina came out saying this should be the standard. And here's what he said about these kind of tests. He said, here's what he thinks schools should be doing. He says these kind of tests can be scaled up, and there's Canadian manufacturers, and there's ways to do this. It is a strip of paper that you put your saliva on. You can get results in 10 minutes. It is not nearly as accurate as the nasal swabs, which is why people aren't using it. But he said, think of it this way. If you get results in 10 minutes, if you get a false result today, but then tomorrow you might get a false result, the next day you're not likely to keep getting false results if you have it. So you can take a test and get something back in 10 minutes, and let's say it's 70% accurate, 80% accurate, but you're taking 5 tests a week, you're likely to eventually track down where you've got actual cases, and you can do it in pretty good real time as opposed to right now, waiting for nasal swabs to be anywhere from 2 to 7 days. Or if you're in Arizona, I don't know, 12 days, 2 weeks. I mean, what is the use of those? He wants to see every school district saying everyone who comes into the building does essentially a spit test. And he says that'll become the standard throughout the pandemic if things go the way that he thinks they probably should. He is one of the few people, I'd say there's a few others arguing for this, but he is a real name in the field. And I'm curious to know, Superintendent McGowan, if you've heard anything about something like that.
No, I haven't heard anything about it. I think that there's, you know, a huge number of concerns around privacy management of a public health initiative like that within the school building. It's not necessarily our place. I think it's an interesting concept to explore, and perhaps that kind of testing being widely available would help in the community. I'm not sure about that happening each day at school, though.
I am, by the way, way ahead of myself, and I'm trying to sum up what Dr. Mina was saying this weekend. So please, listeners, research and read on your own here, because I don't advise. Well, Evan said that it's available now, and we should all just do it. No, you can't snap your fingers, but he's saying that if we go in this direction, maybe we could. Superintendent Kasorek, have you heard anything about that?
I haven't, and I would say that, yes, we don't want to necessarily be providing that testing at the doorstep of the school if there was more research behind it, and definitely would want the support from the medical experts in the greater Rochester area to put together maybe a countywide type protocol where that was something that possibly happened at home. It's an interesting concept, and I will also say, is although you don't mind the swab, I know that many parents have contacted me and are very concerned about their children receiving that swab on a regular basis. So until testing can become more accessible, quicker return, and less inconvenient, unfortunately, I know we're talking about a pandemic, but less more doable for students, that they're not necessarily on board.
I hear the concern of parents, and I am a parent. My 8-year-old has gotten tested once. He was a true champ with it. And, you know, parents, we underestimate our kids. Our kids are doing so well with masking. They are adapting so well. I mean, let's not put it past our kids to make the adaptations necessary for however long this pandemic goes, because they probably want to be in school and they want to be learning and they want these opportunities. And we're talking to Superintendents Casey Kasorek and Kevin McGowan from Hilton and Brighton. I'm way late for our only break, and we're going to squeeze in as many of your phone calls after our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, community members in Irondequoit are gearing up for a townwide discussion about Ibram X. Kendi and Jason Reynolds' book Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You. It's touted as a remix of Kendi's best-selling book Stamped from the Beginning, written in a conversational way for young readers. We'll talk about it. Then, psychology writer Guy Harrison on why we fall for conspiracy theories. Talk with you Wednesday. All right, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's move as fast as we can through the phone calls. Oh, we lost Heidi in Brighton. I'm just going to ask her question to Superintendent McGowan. She just wants to know, can parents get the curriculum so they can teach their kids so they don't have to be online all the time or use the hybrid model? She's wondering if the curriculum is available to parents.
So quite often, and in most cases, our curriculum apps and curriculum material is available online, and certainly we would provide any resources that people are looking for. They're welcome to reach out, and if they can't find it on the website, or if they would like, you know, a more direct answer as to where to find it on the website, we're happy to provide that.
Okay, Superintendent Kasorek?
Yes, they would have access to that, put a request in. If they can't find it on the website, we'll surely provide it.
All right, this is Kimberly in Brighton. Go ahead, Kimberly.
Yes, so two questions. One, as I was driving by Brighton High School, I noticed the sign that said something along the lines of no normal school new taxes, or indicating our taxes should be lower if school is not the same. I'm curious if you could just maybe enlighten those individuals as to why our taxes wouldn't change. Maybe that the use of them would change, reflecting how education is changing this year. I guess touching on that, how it might look different, but why our taxes wouldn't need to be lowered necessarily. And then two, you had mentioned about the children who tested positive, and then there are a couple steps for them to return to school. How are you making sure that those are happening? How are you keeping track of those students to make sure that they return to school?
Okay. Thank you, Kimberly. Superintendent McGowan.
Great question. The no taxes issue is an interesting one. I guess I understand on a very basic surface level why somebody might say that. What they fail to recognize is exactly what the caller pointed out, which is that we may be spending money differently, but we certainly aren't spending less money. I can tell you that much. And if, you know, we think about everything I mentioned around temperature scanners, around an app for attestation on a daily basis, the PPE being provided, additional transportation because we're socially distancing, we are spending money differently. So we may not be paying coaches stipends right now because we don't have sports, yet we are reallocating those funds towards the very expensive process of reopening. And providing an education is still going to happen whether people are within the buildings or not. Our greatest cost factors, which are the people, are still providing a service, and they still will be whether they're in the building or not. The actual cost of being in the building is relatively low relative to the cost of providing the service. And on the second point, the children testing positive, we have a health management software actually that we'll be using to track each child and COVID patient to track their fulfillment of each of the requirements and when they come back, et cetera, and then be providing instruction for them. So we do keep track of every individual through our health offices, through our administrators, and through our counselors.
Okay, and I'll ask Superintendent Kosorik the same, but Paul follows up with a question along these lines. How many positive cases would you need before you decide to close the schools again, Superintendent McGowan?
So there is a particular number. I believe it's a community rate of 5% infection, but the reality is I'm not sure how much that particular number is one for school leaders to be paying attention to, and what I mean is, again, this is a Department of Public Health question because the community transmission rate or infection rate is one thing, the particular school community rate may be higher. So if there's an outbreak in a particular school, at the direction of the Department of Public Health, we would be closing, and that particular number would be something they would explain to us and they would be dictating. It wouldn't necessarily be a number that, for example, Casey and I are looking at on a Tuesday morning, oh, hey, the COVID cases are here, we need to shut down. That is a conversation with Dr. Mendoza, and they would direct us in that regard.
Superintendent Kosorik?
Yes, you know, one thing I think that we also need to note as far as the budgeting process is when the state aid runs came out, there was a pandemic adjustment. So that was a withholding of state aid as well. So some people may see on that basic level that, yes, buses weren't running while we were locked down and shut down. But the reality is when that state aid came through, it came through less than necessary. And then also you compound that with the additional services, PPE, training, additional counseling, all those things that are going to be a byproduct of opening up in a pandemic is clearly something that we have to reallocate our funding to and prepare for. So absolutely, I wish the costs were going down. Unfortunately, the costs are increasing. I think we're roughly in the early stages, $100,000 into preparing for return, and we're calculating over a quarter of a million, possibly half of a million, in our budget for to be completely compliant and be prepared to protect and keep students and staff safe.
All right, Chris in Canandaigua is next. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, so I think I know it's none of the superintendent's really call, I guess you could say, but the reopening in the fall, I think, is just ridiculous. I mean, we see what happened in Georgia. The first day of school, 200-something families are now in quarantine after kids testing positive, and, you know, that viral photo, a hallway where students, you know, almost none of them wearing masks, and, you know, I have kids, too. I have an 11-year-old, and I, you know, she wears her mask when I tell her to, but the second she can, she's not wearing her mask. She's talking to her friend, you know, and I bet you she'll come home with a different mask because she had a sweet trade or something when she went to school. I don't understand. Like, we should just pump the brakes. If, I mean, coronavirus is basically like a common flu. is, I mean, that's the common flu is a coronavirus. So that's spread it easily amongst children. And if COVID-19 is also in that same family, I think it's pretty crazy to think that we're not going to have a serious issue come the fall.
All right, Chris, I'll let the superintendents respond. To be clear, I think what he meant to be saying is the coronavirus is like the flu in terms of its spread. It is not actually an influenza virus. It is a coronavirus, which just means a crown-shaped virus. There have been, I think, four now that have been transmissible that we've been familiar with, SARS, MERS, common cold, and this one. And yes, it's very transmissible. We're still learning a lot about how often kids transmit it, and we don't have a lot of great data that would make us confident making proclamations about it. But I hear the general sentiment. So, Superintendent Kosorek, you want to start with some of Chris's concerns there?
Well, you know, I can speak specific to the Hilton community, and I know we surveyed our parents, and early survey was 96% of families wanted students back 5 days a week. So maybe a little different than the opinion of the caller, but we also have a percentage of folks that want to keep their students at home. I can appreciate pumping the brakes, if you will, because there are so many things that are happening as we're preparing to reopen that are challenges, and we're going to do, you know, as I always tell our community, we're going to do the best we can with the information we have, and information changes quickly. So really trying to take that thought process into keeping everyone safe, but I know there are community members as well that want to say, let's start out remote, let's not do this just quite yet, and that's really where we're between a rock and a hard place.
Superintendent McGowan.
I think it's really important to keep emphasizing this idea of respect for people's choices. We have, in our own home, I'm sending two back to school, our school age, and one off to college, and feel good about doing that. I have the same anxiety that everyone has as a parent and same concern. I feel confident in the plans we've put together, but I get it, and I understand where people are coming from. I think that this is a good thing, but I also respect that people have to make that decision for themselves and for their family, and I'm going to just make clear that we'll continue to support everybody, whatever their choice may be.
Yeah. Jesse in Brighton, we're going to squeeze in one more quick call. Go ahead, Jesse.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So I guess there's been so much talk about engagement of all stakeholders, and I've heard from a lot of teachers that they didn't feel that their voices were really heard in the process. I've seen some teacher-developed plans, like the Massachusetts Teacher Association with a more phased-in approach to reopening. I wonder if you could speak to how actively teachers were involved in your district.
All right, Jesse, thank you. Superintendent McGowan, she's calling from Brighton. I'll start with you.
Sure. On both the Operations Committee and the Instructional Committee, we had many teachers involved. The small groups that met before that with each building principal were all teachers and staff members involved in providing that feedback. We've also provided separate thought exchange surveys and other survey instruments exclusively to teachers and counted that in our feedback, and we work very collaboratively with their union leadership every step of the way. There's a meeting happening right now in the room just next to me with teachers involved with our staff members providing feedback on these approaches too.
Superintendent Kosorek.
Yes, we use the thought exchange software as well, where all staff members and all community members could weigh in. Our reopening teams, if you will, had not only teachers in a teaching capacity, but also union leadership from the teachers' union. We've met with each grade level and department throughout the school district to get their input as well, not only on how they're feeling, but also with instructional decisions. And as the governor has mandated, we'll be holding our three community meetings and also one for staff, which will happen next Wednesday. We send out weekly updates. It's an interactive opportunity for staff to get information, and they can always ask questions. So we feel somewhat comfortable that we've given a lot of communication vehicles for individuals to share their concerns and ask questions.
One more question for both of you. Here's a piece from Stat News today. It's one of the most consistently excellent websites on medical news throughout this pandemic. Here's medical writer Helen Branswell, who's one of the best, under the headline today, Winter is Coming, Why America's Window of Opportunity to Beat Back COVID-19 is Closing. I'm going to quote from her piece. Quote, the good news, the United States has a window of opportunity to beat back COVID-19 before things get much, much worse. The bad news, that window is rapidly closing, and the country seems unwilling or unable to seize the moment. Winter is coming. Winter means cold and flu season. which is all but sure to complicate the task of figuring out who also is sick with COVID-19 and who is suffering from a less threatening respiratory tract infection. It also means that cherished outdoor freedoms that link us to pre-COVID life, pop-up restaurant patios, picnics in the parks, trips to the beach, will soon be out of reach, especially in the northern parts of the country. We should be aiming for no transmission before we open schools and we put kids in harm's way, kids and teachers and their caregivers. And so, if that means no gyms, no movie theaters, no bars, so be it. We seem to be choosing leisure activities now over children's safety in a month's time, and I cannot understand the trade-off. End quote. 45 seconds. Superintendent McGowan, do you agree that there's a trade-off to be made here? Open the schools, fine. Keep gyms, movie theaters, close bars as well.
I think that we have all had to become more comfortable with a certain degree of risk, whether we go to Home Depot, whether we go to Wegmans, Garden Factory, or our favorite restaurant or pub. I think that there is a certain amount of mitigating risk and an acceptance, a certain risk tolerance that we have to think about. I don't disagree entirely with the article. I understand that concern, and I wish nationwide we were doing a whole lot more. But where we have very, very low transmission in a community like ours, I think there's an acceptable amount of risk. I am a parent, too, and I don't mean to sound obtuse to the idea that any risk with a child is a significant one, but I do think it can be managed and managed well.
Superintendent Kosorek, 45 seconds. Go ahead.
I think as well that there's a risk. There's a calculated risk with the low transmission rate right now in upstate New York, with the advisement of Monroe County Health Department, New York State Health Department. It is a calculated risk, and we have to weigh the options of bringing students. I guess the other question is, do our students deserve an education in person? We don't have time to get into remote versus in person, but many students benefit from that social emotional interaction, and I think weighing all that information. But I do respect the article. I think it's thought provoking, and I think it's something that puts everybody in a difficult position to navigate at this point in time. And we all want to do the best we can to keep students safe and give them a quality education.
Well, first of all, to listeners, if you would like to get in touch with us about having students or teachers talk to Connections about reopening, it's connections@wxxi.org. You can send us an email. To the superintendents, Superintendent Kosorek, Superintendent McGowan from Hilton and Brighton, you certainly have plenty to do. You're generous to carve out some time for this program to interact with our listeners. Good luck to you. Let's talk again, and thanks for doing what you're doing.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
And thanks to the engineer of Connections, Rob Braden, the producer, Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.